From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actor B.D. Wong, the prison priest in the HBO series Oz and the forensic psychiatrist in Law & Order SVU. Wong's new memoir is about becoming a father. It's also his coming out. Wong and his longtime partner, Richie Jackson, who was also Wong's agent, had twin sons with the help of a surrogate mother. They were born prematurely. One died. The other almost didn't make it. Also, we talk with filmmaker John Waters. The Broadway adaptation of his 1988 movie Hairspray won 8 Tonys this week. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. Hours after a Palestinian suicide bomber killed 16 people on a Jerusalem bus, witnesses say an Israeli helicopter killed 2 Palestinians in Gaza City. The 2 were identified as members of Hamas. Earlier, an Israeli missile attack killed 7 Palestinians, including 2 top Hamas leaders. President Bush condemned the bus bombing and called on all nations to stop funding terrorist groups. NPR's Linda Gradstein arrived at the scene minutes after the bus explosion.
The bus was almost completely destroyed. The roof was half blown off. All the glass had shattered, and all around the bus it was blackened. You could see that it had burned. Hamas took responsibility for the attack and said it was in revenge for Israel's assassination attempt yesterday on a senior Hamas figure, Abdelaziz Rantisi. Hamas said there would be a series of revenge attacks and that this was only the first one. Less than an hour later, Israeli missiles struck in Gaza. They hit a car that was carrying 2 senior Hamas militants. Israeli officials said one of the men was one of the leaders of the military wing of Hamas, and in that attack, 5 bystanders were also killed.
NPR's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. The Bush administration is calling on the International Atomic Energy Agency to issue a statement of concern about nuclear activity in Iran. U.S. officials believe Iran's nuclear energy program is a cover for clandestine nuclear weapons activity. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
A senior State Department official says that an IAEA report on Iran's nuclear activity is devastating in what it shows about Iran's nuclear capabilities. He says the information in the report is consistent with U.S. allegations that Iran is developing nuclear weapons. The report will be presented to the IAEA Board of Governors in Vienna on Monday. The official, who asked not to be identified, says the U.S. does not expect the IAEA to refer the issue immediately to the U.N. Security Council, as it did the issue of nuclear proliferation by North Korea. Iran insists that its nuclear programs are solely for civilian energy production. Tehran has offered to allow enhanced inspections of its facilities in exchange for access to advanced technology, but the U.S. says no. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
The government has banned the sale of all prairie dogs in response to the monkeypox outbreak. It's also banned pet distributors from importing any more African rodents. Dr. David Fleming of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention describes monkeypox symptoms.
We'd like to recommend, first off, that people who do have prairie dogs or other small rodents in their household as pets who've gotten them since April 15th should be watching their animals for signs of illness. Signs of monkeypox include basically cold-like symptoms.
The monkeypox probe has now spread to 15 states. You're listening to NPR News. Major League Baseball has reduced its suspension of Chicago Cubs home run hitter Sammy Sosa, who used a corked bat in a game. Chicago Public Radio's Ben Calhoun has more.
Major League Baseball officials say they're suspending Sammy Sosa for 7 games instead of 8. Umpires ejected Sosa during a game last Tuesday for using a corked bat. After he was ejected, Sosa said it was his only illegal bat and he'd picked it up by mistake. Now Major League Baseball's chief operating officer Bob Dupay says he's convinced Sosa is telling the truth and that's why the suspension will be reduced. Baseball officials x-rayed almost 80 of Sosa's other bats after the incident but found nothing illegal. Officials announced Sosa's original 8-game suspension last Friday, but allowed him to play over the weekend after he appealed the decision. The Cubs' home run hitting right fielder will have to sit out his 7-game suspension starting today. For NPR News, I'm Ben Calhoun in Chicago.
President Bush used a visit with Chicago-area doctors and senior citizens today to push the House and Senate to pass a new prescription drug benefit for seniors by the 4th of July. The Senate Finance Committee is expected to vote on the matter on Friday. The Senate's top tax writer says the president will have to intervene and break a stalemate between House and Senate Republicans if low-income families are to receive child tax credit rebates that are to be mailed out this summer to middle-income households. The Senate passed a measure last week that expands the credit to low-income families. In stocks, the Dow Industrials gained 128 points to end the day at 91.83 in heavy trading. 1.5 billion shares traded hands. The Nasdaq was up 18 points to 16.46. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Enterprise Florida, the economic development partnership for Florida, helping grow Florida's innovation economy. On the web at eflorida.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Actor B.D. Wong first became known for his starring role in the Broadway show M. Butterfly, for which he won a Tony Award. He's appeared in several films, including the Father of the Bride movies, in which he played Martin Short's assistant. On Law & Order, SVU, he's the forensic psychiatrist, and in the HBO prison series Oz, he played prison chaplain Father Ray Mukata. Here he is in a scene from the first season of Oz, meeting one of the prisoners, Alvarez, for the first time.
Miguel Alvarez. I'm Father Ray Mukata. I'm one of the prison chaplains. According to this file, you're about to be a father. You've got a girlfriend, Maritza. She's an inmate at Parker Women's.
Yeah, we got arrested together. Ain't that sweet?
I can arrange for you to be there for the birth.
I don't give a shit about shit like that.
Miguel, you'll probably be paroled in 2 years. When you get out, you'll want to be a father to your kid.
Is that right? Mira ese pendejo ahí. Man, that's my father. You know, went up in some cell block somewhere as my grandfather, man. So don't be giving me none of your shit.
I get it. You had a miserable childhood. Tough. But let me tell you something. You're still responsible for bringing a new life into this world. You are responsible. The same way that I'm responsible for you, for your soul. So get ready, Miguel Alvarez, because I'm going to be over your shoulder. Comprende? Mi amigo.
B.D. Wong in a scene from Oz. Wong's new memoir is about a part of his life that was not public. He and his longtime partner, Richie Jackson, who is also Wong's agent, decided they wanted to have a child through a surrogate mother. Wong donated the sperm. The egg was donated by Jackson's sister. The surrogate mother was carrying twins, and they were born prematurely. One didn't make it. The survivor, Jackson Fu Wong, is 3 years old. The story of his birth and the difficulty he had surviving the disorder that killed his twin brother is the subject of B.D. Wong's new memoir, Following Fu. Why did you and your partner decide you wanted to have a baby?
I think that the desire to become a parent is, you know, is a natural human, boundary-free thing that happens to you after a certain amount of time in your life. And it just seemed like a very natural thing to desire in your life. I find it kind of actually an odd question. Why? Because I don't think we ask all people that. I don't know. Is there something unique about our being gay that makes it quite more curious? Is that kind of the angle of the question?
Well, I, for instance, have decided not to have children, and a lot of people I know do not have children. So,
well, yes,
when,
that's
when you
true.
Have to go through so much effort to have a child, you
yes.
I mean, it's not happening by accident. It's like,
well taken.
You not only know you want to have a child, you're filling out forms, you're hiring a surrogate,
yes.
You're going through a lot of work. Some people
yes.
kind of casually
right.
want to have children. If it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, it doesn't, or it accidentally happens, or whatever. This is a very decisive move.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, I'm very naive about the fact that I think everybody wants to have kids. You're absolutely right. I felt very strongly about having kids. Now, why, I'm not sure. I do want to have a relationship with my son that is something that grows and enriches my life and both of our lives mutually as the years go on. And I find that one of the, personally for me, one of the potentially most rewarding things that you can experience. And I believe that Richie feels the same way. So together, we had always wanted to do that, and it was just a matter of time before it happened. And it was just a matter of time before I realized that it wasn't going to happen naturally, and that we had to kind of go through a lot of jump through a lot of hoops to see how we could make it happen.
Now, you decided to do this through a surrogate mother as opposed to, you know, adopting.
Yes.
Why did you want to take that route? I mean, I know a lot of people who have adopted and have gone to, like, China or Vietnam to adopt a baby. In some ways, I guess that's easier. In some ways, maybe harder. I don't know. Why did you decide the surrogate route?
We were interested in the idea of having a genetic bond with our baby, both of us. You know, Richie's sister, Sue, donated her eggs, and I fathered the embryos, it was just something that was the first thing we looked into, if you can imagine. We decided we wanted to be parents, and then we were acquainted with this organization, an agency in Los Angeles that matches gay couples with surrogates. And we thought, well, let's look into this and see whether or not it's something we can do. It turned out in our family that, you know, not a lot of gay couples have this particular relationship with a sister who's the right age, who's willing to donate her eggs. And we had that. So we thought, well, let's see if it works. You know, it's something that doesn't really work that dependably, you know, because of the in vitro and all of the technology involved. So we were just looking into it, and we said, you know, if this fails, then there'll be tons of other ways to do it. We just wanted to see if we could do it this way first.
Shauna, the surrogate mother, went into labor after 28 weeks, which is 7 months, and you took her to the hospital. What were the problems that the babies were having? And these were twins.
They were identical twin boys, and they, unbeknownst to us, they were suffering from a condition called twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome, where one twin gives all of his blood and through their shared vascular network to the other. So one of them becomes overloaded with blood and the other one becomes quite anemic. And that was the main reason for their distress and for their announcing their arrival quite so early.
So one of the twins died shortly after birth.
That's right.
And was the other's life in jeopardy?
The other's life was in jeopardy for 3 months after that point, during which time we stayed in intensive care, and we flew him to San Francisco from Modesto, where he was born. And he stayed in a world-class teaching hospital, intensive care nursery at University of California, San Francisco. And yes, he was indeed in jeopardy almost that entire time.
How did the death of your son, Boaz, affect your feelings about your surviving son, Jackson?
I really believe that Boaz gave his life to Jackson. I think that they were both in a fair amount of distress at the time of their birth. And I really believe that, as one doctor put it, they demanded to be born because they knew that they were in terrible danger of both not making it. I have always looked at Boaz in a very heroic way and see him as someone who made a sacrifice, knowing that if they stayed in utero much longer, they both would not have made it. So I think they both kind of said, they did whatever they could. And I mean, certainly they had tried to be born a week earlier and the doctors stopped it with any number of medications. But the second time, there was nothing that could be done to stop them. They came fast and furious. And I believe that not only Boaz gave an incredible gift to his brother, but that his brother always has that gift with him, and it really informs his survival sensibility that he seems to have, and the fact that he was able to make it through that crazy 3 months, I believe is also a gift that is from, you know, kind of an angel's presence in his life.
Can you describe how Jackson looked when he was born prematurely?
Well, I laugh because, you know, the name of the book is Following Foo, The Electronic Adventures of the Chestnut Man, and everybody wants to know why he was called the Chestnut Man. And really, the only reason is because somebody asked me, what does he look like? And I said, well, he looks like a chestnut man. And I meant those old guys in the corner in New York who were selling chestnuts in the winter at Christmas time, and they're just kind of huddled over the coals and trying to make it, you know, and very, very kind of wizened and old. And you know how they say that you don't look again like you were when you were a baby until you're very, very old. So he did resemble a very, very old man, you know, a tiny, tiny, less than 3-pound old man. And he did look very, very frail and he was very small, Terry. He was 2 pounds, 13 ounces. And you know, by the time that I saw him, he was hooked up to all of those traditional premature infant kind of apparatus. And yet at the same time, he had a resilience. He was very, very unresistant to all of the poking and prodding that he endured that entire time. And I found that actually kind of inspiring.
He had to have a lot of medical procedures, including intestinal surgery.
Yes, he did.
Which is, you know, it's pretty difficult for anybody, but you're looking at this like 2 pound baby having it.
Yeah. At 2 weeks of age, you know.
Yeah. So was it difficult to deal with all of the helplessness? I mean, here you have this like helpless 2 pound some ounce baby getting, you know, intestinal surgery, and you're the worried father, and it's not like you can talk to your baby and tell it not to worry. First of all, that would be false. And second of all, you know, it's just a baby. I mean, you're helpless. He's helpless. I guess my question is dealing with so much helplessness.
Yeah. Well, that is a huge part of what I wrote about during this time. I wrote these emails to all of our friends and family, reaching out to them and telling them, you know, how things were going, because every day there were all of these kind of medical twists and turns, which is very, very traditional for a premature infant. And the helplessness is really kind of the main source of, in some ways, the ironic hilariousness of it, if you can imagine. I know that sounds really strange, but here I was in this impossible situation, you know, tearing my hair out and crying and doing all of these things. And I did feel incredibly helpless. And his helplessness was less of an issue for me. I mean, I was just happy that he was there in this incredibly wonderful place with these incredible, incredibly gifted and committed people to take care of him. And so I felt less helpless about that. And I also felt like his helplessness was kind of taken care of by their expertise and knowledge, you know.
How's your son Jackson's health now? He's what, about 3?
He just turned 3, yeah, last Tuesday, as a matter of fact. And he's very well, and I appreciate your asking. He is obviously, as you can imagine, a great joy for us, and we are very grateful for him. We don't know really necessarily, or we haven't been shown what, if any, challenges he may have in the future, but he really seems great now.
If you're just joining us, my guest is actor B.D. Wong. His new memoir about his son is called Following Fu. This book is, in a way, you're coming out, your official coming out to...
Officially, yeah.
Right. Yeah, you've been acting for years. Why was this the occasion, and why wait until now?
Well, the answer to the second part of the question, why wait until now, has a lot to do with the fear of never working. You know, when you're mm-hmm. an actor, can be a very... actors have a kind of comic reputation for being self-involved and neurotic. And there are real reasons for any actor who actually is self-involved and neurotic. First of all, the craft of acting requires you to use your essence, your soul, in the work. It's not like any other craft in the world. I mean, even a musician plays an instrument which is not him. For me, coming out was put at bay because of my own neuroses about, you know, the opportunities that were all already very slim for me when I entered the field as an Asian American. And I held it very highly, the kind of practical consideration of, wow, gee, if you came out, that would really be like cutting your arm off in some ways, wouldn't it? And I think over the years, I've discovered that the answer is no, it wouldn't necessarily. I think it's up to me to, in some ways, create my own career. And so the book kind of told me that this was exactly the right time to share myself fully with everyone, with the world, and with myself in some ways. And that was really an important kind of turning point for me.
You were concerned that coming out might have an adverse effect on your career. I think it's interesting, at the Tony Awards on Sunday, it just seemed to be kind of dominated by gay-themed shows and gay actors. The songwriters who won for Hairspray declared their love and kissed. Harvey Fierstein won, and of course he performs in drag in Hairspray. I should mention he's represented by your partner Richie. Richie's his agent.
Yes.
The director and star of Take Me Out, which is about a gay baseball player, won Tony's. Do you think that that's a sign that, well, things are really changing?
It is kind of a sign. I mean, it is a, you know, Broadway and the theater are a very special place. And they are, you know, in some ways, Broadway and the theater are a home for a lot of show business disenfranchised people, including people, ethnic minorities and gay people. So there is a sense of safety that people feel in the theater. Now, the Tony Awards are an example of the commercial theater. And I think what you're saying is on national TV for 3 hours, to have that unabashed kind of and celebratory display of you know, art, not only artistic creative expression, which includes gay themes, but you know, gay artists who are don't feel the need to edit themselves on national TV. I think that is an example or an indication that there is a comfort zone that didn't exist a few years ago, and that is immensely encouraging. I mean, that's the kind of thing that we need as a society to kind of break down some of these barriers.
My guest is B.D. Wong. His new memoir about becoming a father is called Following Fu. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is actor B.D. Wong. He has a new memoir about becoming a father called Following Fu. While your son was born prematurely and his life was so fragile, it was just like hanging in the balance and it was one emergency procedure after another, you're running back and forth to New York shooting Oz.
Yes. Is,
I mean, for anyone who hasn't seen Oz, I mean, Oz is the HBO series, or was the HBO series, about like the meanest, most sadistic, and most handsome convicts in TV history.
Well, it's the antithesis to kind of stable parental energy, I think.
Yes, you absolutely. Know,
I think that's what you're saying.
That's exactly it.
In some ways, that's of great relief when you're going through something like that. If you can imagine, you know, I was able to get away from the hospital and the stress of that for a moment and see my, you know, great friends who supported me so unflinchingly during this time. And that was only a positive thing. The content of the show is something people are often very, very intrigued by, and even the content of the other show that I'm on, Law and Order Special Victims Unit, there are these kind of really deep and dark kind of themes that are in these two shows, and I don't know why I'm on both of them, but be that as it may, people are often intrigued by what it's like to shoot them, and for me, it's really not at all an entry or a journey into the dark. It's really, I'm able to separate the make-believe aspect of it quite easily, and so it becomes quite fun for me actually to do these shows. And creatively, it was a release for me to be able to work while I was doing all of this. I can't say that I didn't find it interesting and rather ironic and funny that it was this particular show that I was doing, and that then I would run back to this very, very different world.
And of course, on Oz, you play the chaplain, so you're always literally trying to do God's work in the
trying,
prison.
Yes.
Trying,
yes.
Well,
I wasn't always
failing,
quite so successful.
Right, yes.
Yeah.
One of the really interesting things about Oz is the audience that it has. On the one hand, it has all these, you know, people who are interested in gangsters, and it has like a big hardcore rap audience because there's a lot of rap music on the show and you know, guest rap stars and stuff. But it also has a big gay following because, you know, it's this real men's show, and there's a lot of men having sex with men on the show. And also you have these, like, you know, rappers who make appearances on the show, but you also have these cabaret stars, Rita Moreno, Patti LuPone,
Betty Buckley, right.
Betty Buckley, exactly. And even the actor who plays Vern Schillinger, the neo-Nazi, J.K. Schilling, you know, was one of the stars of Guys and Dolls. So it's just in terms of the population of the show and the population of its audience, it's so intriguing.
It is. I mean, there are a lot of different reasons. You know, New York actors are a very special breed, and the show shoots in the New York area and or shot in the New York area. And so Tom Fontana and casting for Oz utilized so many of these wonderful performers, many of whom are Broadway musical performers because they're people from that area. So there was a kind of geographic reason for that. And there was a reason also that Tom has a great love for these performers. I mean, he's not a particular Broadway musical fan, but he really appreciates the work of some of these actors and wrote parts for them and stuff like that. So, it is interesting. It gave the show, I mean, who would think that a show that was so full of such kinds of characters would also be full of people from Broadway musicals? That seems very odd, but it's true. And then and there was actually even an episode that he wrote, which was musical and that people sang in.
Oz has certainly boosted your recognition. Has it changed your career? Are you getting offered different kinds of parts than you, or more parts than you were before?
Well, you know, I spent a fair amount of time when I was just starting out in movies doing a lot of really kind of nutty comedy. And so it has been great for me to kind of reconnect to, I don't know, what I would call real acting, what I would call kind of three-dimensional character study and human relationship kind of acting. And this was definitely the one great forum that I have had in the recent past to do that kind of work. And I feel that that has balanced out my persona and allowed people to allow me to do that kind of work more than just the kind of silly comedy stuff.
B.D. Wong's new memoir about becoming a father is called Following Fu. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Lost in Translation, a novel about an American woman experiencing Beijing for the first time, by Nicole Moniz. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's Madison time. Hit it.
Coming up, Hairspray. The Broadway musical won 8 Tony Awards on Sunday. It's adapted from John Waters' 1988 movie. We'll talk with Waters about the movie, the show, and the Tony ceremony. Then we continue our interview with actor B.D. Wong.
Hit time. You're looking good. Now when I say hit it, I want you to go 2 up and 2 back, double cross, come out of it with the rifleman. Hit time. Now when I say hit it, I want the big strong M, erase it and back to the mask. Hit it. Walk on, you're looking good. Now then, when I say tea time. Hit it.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actor B.D. Wong. He played the prison chaplain Father Ray Mukata in the HBO series Oz, and plays the forensic psychiatrist in Law and Order, SVU. Wong has a new memoir called Following Fu. It's about becoming a father. Wong and his longtime partner, Richie Jackson, became parents with the help of a surrogate mother. Your first really big role was M. Butterfly on Broadway. You won a Tony Award for that. And you played a Chinese opera star who passes as a woman but is really a man. And John Lithgow played the American diplomat who falls in love with you thinking that you are a woman, and then has to deal with all the subsequent confusion. How did you get the part?
I got the part through, a kind of exhaustive kind of talent search for this kind of extremely unique creature, a man that could physically pass for a woman, who could sing and do, physically handle the Chinese opera, which is a very difficult, theatrical medium, and also could really play, ironically enough, could convincingly play a man in the third act of the play. I was in Los Angeles at the time, kind of doing bit parts on Simon and Simon and, TV shows like that, and I got this call from the agent saying there's a Broadway show that you can get an audition for if you fly yourself to New York, and I said I didn't have the money to fly to myself to New York. But, send me the script, whatever, I'll look at the script. I've always wanted to do a Broadway play. Is it a good part? And I called my parents right away and said, I need some money to go to New York. I have to go to an audition for this play. This is unbelievable. And this is going to change somebody's life. And I don't really think I could ever get this part, but I really do think that I should try and I'll meet some great people. And so they did lend me some money to go to New York. And I went on a, cheapy little airline flight. I flew myself to New York and I put myself before them. And they bit, and it was incredible. It was an incredible experience from that time in my life when I was very idealistic and really wanted to work as an actor very passionately.
What are the odds that the breakthrough role that you get is a role that's written for someone who's both Asian and gay?
Well, and it's not written for a gay. It's not written for a gay person.
No, but I mean the character is gay.
Yes, and well, that's there. That's a, I don't know.
Part of the whole ambiguity, right? Yeah.
Yes, I mean the world of the play exists in a very strange kind of a world that cannot necessarily be defined with our own kind of conventional definitions.
But you get the point.
But I can totally get the point.
Yeah.
I'm always very, very, as you can tell, I'm very, very protective of the character and all of that stuff. Now that I'm out, I think it can be clear that the reasons why is because I'm not protecting my own reputation or sexuality, but because I really feel that the play works on a level that transcends traditional sexual orientation. However, what were the odds? The odds are, very slim. It was incredible. I knew that when I read the script, I thought, I cannot, holy cow, I'm reading the script and everything that they're asking this person to do, I can do. And I really meant that, actors do that a lot, but I was thinking, wow, this is incredible. I can do these things. I could compete for this part, and I could really compete for it in a big way. I mean, I have this kind of freaky soprano voice that I can sing in. I have this voice that I can, I had a lot of the ingredients, and they were very kind of bizarre ingredients in some ways. I had, a background in musical theater, and I had a sensibility that allowed me to really also, this is the most important thing probably, to get the part, to understand what the person needed to do and how it should be played and how to kind of get it. Not only just that I could get it, but how to get it. And so I was lucky. It was very, very, a very, very good match for them too, because I was, the right age when it happened. It wasn't like, what happened, I read the script and it was like, oh, it's too late. The script finally came along, or I'm too young or I'm too old, So you're right. It was really interesting that way.
No, it's funny. David Henry Wong, who wrote M. Butterfly, wrote the book for the revival of Flower Drum Song, which was on Broadway. And the funny thing is, Flower Drum Song was always like the stereotype of the only parts for Asian actors available in America, particularly on Broadway. And it was the part that I think Asian actors looked to avoid. You know, I don't want to do a Flower Drum Song kind of role.
Right. It was the kind of thing. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering if you finish your thought and then I'll tell you what I was
thinking. Well, I was going to say that we've always had a real love-hate relationship with Flower Drum Song. And so in one way, we would turn the TV on and the movie Flower Drum Song on, and we'd be so thrilled that there were Asian people on the TV, and that we were so thrilled that the Chinatown and the Chinese-American community were being depicted. And at the same time, there was a sense of kind of patronization or something that really made us uncomfortable on a certain level. And it was always very hard for me to negotiate these two feelings of going, well, there's this thing, there is Flower Drum Song, and yet at the same time, yeah, but Flower Drum Song is still Flower Drum Song and was created by non-Chinese people as a kind of idea of what it means to be Chinese-American. And that is what David really reinvented, was owning the point of view of the show. And saying, well, if it's about Chinese Americans, then if, as a Chinese American, this is what I think it's really about to be Chinese American. And he imbued this kind of quaint old show with some very, very modern social values.
One of the TV shows that you were cast in was the Margaret Cho short-lived sitcom All-American Girl.
Yes.
And she talks about that show in her stand-up act and, you know, in her one-woman show. And
brilliantly, yeah.
Yeah, so did that show strike you as something that was a breakthrough, or that had to be forced to succumb to stereotype?
Well, you know, unfortunately, it was a little bit like the Flower Drum Song of the 90s. It was the show that was so... We were also looking forward to it. I mean, I was looking forward to it as a member of the Asian American community, as just a consumer. And it was the first Asian American family, if you can believe it, on television. In 1995, the first Asian American family on a television sitcom was Margaret Cho. And so we were thrilled by it. And then we got there and we realized, I think, the main thing I think that really happened, to boil it all down, is that they weren't able to properly channel Margaret's unique essence. I mean, she was completely turned into a completely different thing, and it became very false. And that false core resonated throughout the entire show. So the whole show had a kind of falseness to it, and a sense of kind of sitcom-y. The potential was great, and then the show's creation was actually, there was nothing important about it. There was nothing revolutionary or even challenging about it. It just became kind of a generic television sitcom with this incredibly gifted person, a genius, if you will, at its center that was totally not being tapped. And that was really sad to be a part of that. I mean, it was so disillusioning, and certainly it did a number on her, as she talks about in her shows, and on many different levels. And it was really hard.
Now, your parents grew up in Chinatown. What did Chinatown mean to you when you were growing up?
Chinatown was, I had a very, you know, I really appreciate the question. I had a very, very tough time in my childhood, particularly when I decided that I wanted to be an actor, because I blamed my Asian Americanness for being the thing that would keep me from having what I wanted. And so I started to really go through a whole number, did a whole number on myself, not being rather ashamed of being Asian American, being ashamed of being Chinese, and wanting to assimilate to a point of exaggeration almost, where I tried to really ignore that part of me. So I didn't have a great relationship with Chinatown earlier on in my childhood. I didn't appreciate it. I didn't appreciate what it could represent to me, certainly the way that I do now. And I didn't want to have anything to do with anything Chinese or Asian American. Now, since then, I have gone on an incredible journey of self-acceptance sounds really rather lame. It's a kind of self-love, of self-discovery and understanding what it is that makes me me, including being gay. But being Asian American is another facet of who I am, which is terrific. It's beautiful and wonderful and very individual, and not any more individual than anything else, but individual nevertheless. And reaching that conclusion and being able to share that I feel that way with younger people who might feel the way I felt then is very, very empowering to me. And the journey has been really incredible. You know, my parents were great role models as Chinese Americans and just as parents. And I didn't always get it because I was, for a lot of reasons. You know, the media doesn't help us to love ourselves when we're Asian American. It just doesn't. There is not a lot of validation for Asian Americans on television, in the movies, in the magazines, anywhere. And so that causes a lot of problems for young kids. I certainly speak from personal experience. At the time when I grew up, it was a big deal, and it caused feelings of shame that were really, really heavy, and has taken me to, it took me the huge threshold of M. Butterfly to understand how great it could be to be Asian American as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an equation that was very valuable to me and very, very welcome at that time. Here was a Chinese American playwright who wrote this play about a Chinese American guy who had this experience with the Caucasian majority that was validating to me and was able to be put up on the stage and celebrated, and that really changed my life.
Well, B.D. Wong, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
B.D. Wong's new memoir about becoming a father is called Following Fu. The Broadway musical Hairspray won 8 Tonys Sunday. It's based on John Waters' 1988 film Hairspray. Coming up, we talk with Waters about the movie, the musical, and the Tonys. This is Fresh Air. The Broadway musical Hairspray won 8 Tony Awards Sunday night, including Best Musical, Book, Score, Actress, Actor, and Director. The story, set in the 1960s, is about a chubby girl who becomes the surprise star of the local dance show. The musical is adapted from the 1988 movie Hairspray, which was written and directed by John Waters. He doesn't usually win mainstream awards. His trademark is bad taste. His movie Pink Flamingo is about a competition to become the filthiest person alive, helped start the midnight movie craze. We called Waters earlier today to talk about Hairspray and its sweep at the Tonys. John Waters, first of all, I want to say congratulations on the big success of Hairspray at the Tonys.
Well, thank you. It was amazing to me also, believe me.
Did you ever imagine yourself having this Broadway musical adaptation of one of your movies?
I guess I didn't, but you know, if anybody had ever asked me which one of your movies would make a Broadway play, I probably would have picked this one. And the very first table reading we ever went to of this, which is when you have a few of the actors, they had Marissa, they had Harvey, and they do a reading of it. And I went by myself because I was so nervous and I had no idea what to expect. And I loved it so much that secretly I did feel, you know, this could be a hit, but you never say something like that out loud because as soon as those kind of feelings hit the air, it turns into bad luck and you curse yourself. But from the very beginning, things went very, very well with us.
The Tony Awards were kind of like this gay festival.
It was the GLAAD Awards.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the songwriters for Hairspray declared their love and then they kissed.
I know. Which caused a big stink, which I didn't ever even think of when it happened. I didn't even realize that. And I said to him the next night, because we went to a tribute to Margot Lyon, the producer, and I said, "You're the Rosa Parks now of the gay movement." But it seemed so amazing to me that people were surprised by that. I thought it was kind of touching.
Can you compare the two cultures, having worked in both Hollywood now and Broadway, just as kind of cultures, and also like how gay, you know, being gay figures into it? Like, mm-hmm. In other words, like which...
Well, I don't know that being gay really figures in it that much for me, because I'm gaily incorrect. They don't know quite what's the matter with me. They always think that being gay is the least of my problems, if somebody's going to be against me. I don't know. I've made 13 or 14 movies, and I've only been involved with one Broadway show. And the one Broadway show seemed charmed from the very beginning. Nothing bad ever happened. I liked all the people. I liked everybody that was cast in it. I loved the music. It was just amazing. You don't ever get many of them in life, even if you get one, and this was it. So I'm certainly enjoying it. What is different when you see a movie and a play is that a play, I realize, is one long medium shot. That is, you get no editing, no sound mixing, everything. You just have to get this one shot. That's 2.5 hour long, and you have to keep refining it till it's perfect. And that's what a play is compared to a movie.
Do you think that the Broadway adaptation of Hairspray really expresses your sensibility, or do you think it's terrific but a different sensibility than yours?
I think it completely does give their original sensibility, and that's what Margot Lyon, the producer, said to me at the first dinner, that she wanted to keep the John Waters voice in this. People forget, Hairspray was a PG movie. This would be PG-13, I think. This has double entendres in it, where Hairspray didn't even have that.
But I'm thinking, like, the music in the Broadway version of Hairspray is different. Like, in the movie, you used some original but obscure recordings from the 60s. Soul music and obscure novelty dance records.
Yeah.
And this is all, like, original music written in the style of, but not the authentic real thing.
Yes, because there was very little, except for the title song, Hairspray, in the movie, there was no original music. Hairspray was my dance movie. Crybaby was my musical. That was the one with all different, with original music in it. So this was certainly the same with the choreography. They didn't do the same dances that are in it, but they completely kept it authentic. They took, you know, I didn't even like Broadway musicals so much. I did as a kid, but recently they all just seemed so corny and everything. But I think Mark Shaiman and Scott Whitman took what we used to love about musicals and used that and turned Hairspray into that, which I don't think we had had that kind of musical for a while. They were all so feel good that you want to gag. And this is feel good too, but it's about a fat girl who gets the guy, and about a loving mother played by a man, and the most touching love story is between two men doing kind of an old vaudeville dance on the Broadway stage. So I think it breaks a lot of rules, but you don't realize it when you're watching it.
You said you loved Broadway musicals when you were young.
Yeah.
What musicals did you really love?
Well, Mary Martin, Peter Pan, Captain Hook is who I thought I was as a child. I wore a coat hanger. I wore my father's neckties, scotch tape to my head to look like long hair. Cyril Richard. And you look at him now and you think, oh, my God. I wish somebody would do the biography of Cyril Richard. He needs a great revival. He was such a great villain to me. But even the theater in any way, Patty McCormick and The Bad Seed on Broadway, I was amazed. I would try to go to the library and look up anything I could find out about her, that little girl murderess as a kid. So musicals, and then later Gypsy certainly was a musical, but you got to get a gimmick. I mean, that I've tried to make come true in my life.
Could you imagine a musical of any of your early films like Pink Flamingos?
It has been optioned to be an opera before, a long
time opera?
Ago. Yes, I think it would be a good opera. I can tell you it would be. I think that would be a good opera. I think Crybaby would be a very good musical. I think Serial Mom would be an ice show. I can go through all of them. A quiz show, a reality show. That would maybe be Pink Flamingos also, considering the end.
Well, describe what Pink Flamingos is like. You know, describe what it's about for people who haven't seen it you envision it as an opera.
Okay, well, Pink Flamingos was a battle between two groups of outcasts of who could be the filthiest person. person alive. And I guess if that would be an opera, it was sort of mad scenes, the whole movie. So, and the end, which was a stunt, really, basically a ludicrous publicity stunt where Divine ate, well, dog do. And I think that could be, if played very seriously, an incredible opera building to that. And I do actually have a tape of an opera someone did of it. So you never know what's going to happen, Terry. I mean, things change so many times through the years that one day Pink Flamingos could be on network television, a movie that I almost went to jail for and others did. So you don't know what's going to happen in America. Things so rapidly change what is accepted, what is humor, what's funny, what isn't, that it's you just sort of sit back sometimes out of breath.
My guest is screenwriter and director John Waters. The Broadway musical Hairspray is based on his 1988 movie of the same name. Hairspray swept at the Tonys Sunday night. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with John Waters. The Broadway musical Hairspray is adapted from his 1988 movie of the same name. Hairspray won 8 Tonys Sunday night, including Best Score, Book, Actor, Actress, and Director. For any listeners who have not seen the show or the movie Hairspray and aren't familiar with the story, could you describe the basic story?
It's about a teenage dance show in Baltimore that where the local kids become celebrities on it. And it's where, by dancing every day on television, and their personal lives sort of become the soap opera of the day for the home viewers. And it's about a fat girl who gets initially rejected from the show and then gets on it, becomes a star, integrates the show, because at the time in 1962, all the shows were segregated, and gets the boy to top it off. So the fat girl gets the boy and wins, which doesn't always happen in real life.
And what was the dance show that this was inspired by?
Well, it was a show called The Buddy Dean Show that came on in Baltimore. And Buddy's still alive. He's coming to the opening in Baltimore of The Road when we open on The Road in the fall. And it was, we never had Dick Clark. We never had American Bandstand in Baltimore. There was no such thing. And because we had the local version that was a little more extreme, where the girls had bigger hair and the boys wore pointier toe shoes. But all the stars came there, and a lot of times Buddy Dean would break songs that would start and then go up to Dick Clark. He would make them famous here first.
And did you ever audition for the show?
I never auditioned. My parents would have never let me be on it, but I did go on it twice. I went on it with Mary Vivian Pierce once, and they asked us to leave because we did the Dirty Boogie, which was the only dance you were not allowed to do on Buddy Dean. And another time I went when they had a live show at the Timonium Fairgrounds, where sometimes they would go on location, and I went on it as a guest. You could go on as a guest, too, but the committee was only allowed, that was the people that were on every day, only allowed to dance with a regular every No, they had to dance with a regular every dance, and you could only dance with a fellow committee member every 4 songs.
So what's the Dirty Boogie?
The Dirty Boogie was kind of like a lot of bumping and grinding, and kind of, you can see it in the movie. In the movie, they do it in Motor Mouth's record shop, and it was pretty dirty, especially for its time. I guess it was based on burlesque moves or something, but it was the one dance you were definitely not allowed to do. And we used to do it mostly to the song Hide and Seek by Bunker Hill. That was the best Dirty Boogie number.
So you were thrown off the broadcast?
Well, they said you can't do that. Stopping them, the cameras would have never shown. No, you didn't. It wasn't that good. We weren't, like, bodily ejected. No, they just came over and said you can't do that, and, of course, they didn't show it. And at record hops, you see, they would have personal appearance at record hops. I did win Do the Twist with Ray Charles, a record album, by winning the Twist contest with Mary Lou Raines, who was the biggest queen of the Buddy Dean show at the time.
So how did you know her?
I didn't know her. You just, when you went to the record house, they just came over real bored and would ask you to dance. They had to. That was their job.
Oh.
They had to dance with the guests. And they still have big reunions and come. And it's amazing kind of to see, you know, 60-year-old women doing the locomotion is a sight to see.
The role of Edna Turdblad, the mother in Hairspray, was played in the movie by Divine, an actor who appeared in most of your films and you know, died a few years ago.
Well, he died a week after Hairspray the movie opened.
Right.
And people forget Hairspray the movie was a hit too, but I don't remember what happened because Divine died. So it put this horrible damper on it.
Right.
And I've said before, but Hairspray the musical on Broadway hopefully is the continuation maybe of the joy I would have had from that movie if Divine had not died so soon after it had opened and he had gotten the best reviews of his life.
So how is the success of Hairspray the Broadway musical affecting your career as a filmmaker?
Well, I think success always helps. I mean, the movie I'm hoping to do this fall is about sex addicts who after their concussion experience a carnal lust they can never control. It's not exactly Hairspray territory. But there is all sorts of extremes in both directions for a John Waters movie these days.
Well, John Waters, congratulations, and thanks very much for talking with
us. Thanks, Terry.
John Waters wrote and directed the 1988 film Hairspray. The Broadway musical adaptation won 8 Tony Awards on Sunday. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross. Here's a duet from Hairspray with two of its Tony Award winners, Harvey Fierstein and Dick Latessa.
Fads keep a-fading, Castro's invading, but Wilbur, you're timeless to me. Hairdos are higher, mine feels like barbed wire, but you say I'm chic as can be. You're like a rare vintage ripple, a vintage they'll never forget. So pour me a teeny-weeny triple, and we can toast the fact we ain't dead yet. Ha! I can't stop eating, your hairline's receding. Soon there'll be nothing at all. So you'll wear a wig while I roast a pig. Hey, pass that geritol. Glad Mila had class. That chubby check is a gas. But they all piss eventually. You'll never be passé. Hip hooray. You're timeless to me.
Oh, and the baby dance with me.
Oh, Wilma. Oh, you make me feel like a girl again.
Oh, honey, show him the bumper.
Oh, honey, I think my bumper's stuck in neutral.
Well, don't break it. We may need it later.
What do you think of this one, big boy?
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Can you feel that all the way over there? You're like a broken down Chevy. All you need is a fresh coat of paint.
And Edna, you got me going hot and heavy. You're fat and old, but baby, boring you ain't. Some folks don't get it, but we never fret it, 'cause we know that time is our friend. And it's plain to see that you're stuck with me until the bitter end.
And we got a kid who's holding the lid on the turn. You'll always hit the spot, big shot.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback The Emperor of Ocean Park by Stephen Carter. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Hillary Clinton on life in the White House and the Senate, and her thoughts on the sex scandal that nearly ended her marriage and her husband's presidency. Clinton's new memoir is called Living History. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.